maids in lilac print gowns escorted guests into her presence. Invariably, they were enchanted. "Such loveliness of line and tinting, such sweet courtesy of manner," gushed Mrs. Burton Harrison, a memoirist of the period. Of five or six gentlewomen whose birth, breeding, and tact established them as the flowers of New York society, Mrs. Theodore Roosevelt seemed to me easily the most beautiful. Her exquisite looks were balanced by exquisite taste. Not surprisingly, for someone who made such a delicate pastel picture of herself, she was a connoisseur of painting and sculpture. She filled her house with the finest furniture and porcelain, and her need for everything that was beautiful is said to have strained even the considerable Roosevelt resources. Theodore Sr. acknowledged that her palate for wine was superior to his own, and never paid for a consignment until she had personally approved it. Mitty was a woman of considerable wit. Her letters, written in a delicate Italian hand, show flashes of inventive humor. As a storyteller, especially when recounting what her enraptured children called slave tales, she revealed great gifts of mimicry. One evening, at a family party, she grimaced her way through a piece called Old Bess in a Fit, while Theodore Sr., who could not bear seeing her lovely face distorted, tried in vain to stop her. Eventually, he was reduced to picking her up like a doll and carrying her out of the room on his shoulder. From his father, young Teedy inherited the sturdy Dutch character of Claes Martensen van Rozenvelt, one of the early settlers of New Amsterdam, who stepped ashore sometime in 1649. From that day on, for the next two centuries, every generation of Roosevelts, Teedy being the seventh, was born on Manhattan Island. Oom Claes had been a farmer, but subsequent Roosevelts ascended rapidly in the social scale, becoming manufacturers, merchants, engineers, and bankers. A Roosevelt had served in the New York State Senate and helped ratify the Constitution with Alexander Hamilton. Another had received his bride from the hands of General Lafayette. Industrious and honest, the family amassed a comfortable fortune. Teedy's grandfather, Cornelius Van Schaak Roosevelt, was worth $500,000 at a time when the average daily wage was 50 to 75 cents. The only non-Dutch infusion that Teedy received through his father was that of Grandmother Roosevelt, but it was a rich admixture of Welsh, English, Irish, Scotch-Irish, and German strains traceable back to immigrant Quakers. Strangely enough, she, and not old Cornelius, taught Teedy the only Dutch he ever knew, a nursery song. Triple triple tunties, keepen in die boonties. 50 years later, when he went hunting in Africa, he sang this song to Boer settlers and found that they recognized it. "It was interesting," he wrote, "to meet these men whose ancestors had gone to the Cape about the time that mine went to America 2.5 centuries previously, and to find that the descendants of the two streams of immigrants still croon to their children some at least of the same nursery songs." From his mother, Teedy acquired several refined French traits. Although her forebears were predominantly Scots, James Bullock of Glasgow immigrated to Charleston in 1729, they had early married into the Huguenot family of Devaux. Mitty, with her rococo beauty and elegance of manner, could have been mistaken for a Frenchwoman, and she passed on to Teedy a certain Gallic volubility. The Bullocks also contributed aristocratic qualities not shared by the Roosevelts. Whereas Oom Claes had been a man of the soil, ranking far below Governor Peter Stuyvesant, James Bullock was a learned planter who could entertain Governor James Edward Oglethorpe on equal terms. Unlike the Roosevelts, who with two or three exceptions preferred the security of commerce to the glamour of politics, the Bullocks stepped naturally into positions of power. Among his direct maternal ancestors, Teedy could count six distinguished politicians, including Archibald Bullock, the first president of Revolutionary Georgia. Few Americans, surely, have been born into such a perfectly balanced home environment as the son of Theodore and Mitty Roosevelt. There was a harmony of southern refinement and northern vigor, feminine humor and masculine seriousness, and, later on, the rewards of privilege and the responsibilities of charity. Through the front window of the house, Teedy looked down on carriages and cobblestones, and heard coming from Broadway and Fifth Avenue the rumble and throb of a great city. Through the rear window, he gazed out into another world, an enormous block-wide garden full of trees and flowers, roamed by ornamental peacocks. Were it not for the weight of asthma in his lungs, he might consider himself a child of paradise. But then, 5 months after his second birthday, Southern cannons fired upon Fort Sumter, and the harmonies of 28 East 20th Street were jarred into discord. When war was declared on 12 April 1861, Teedy and his 6-year-old sister Anna, Bammy, had been joined by a 14-month-old brother, Elliot, Ellie, and Mittie Roosevelt was already pregnant with her final child, Corrine, Coney, who arrived in the fall. No sooner had the last been born than Theodore Sr. left home, and sadness filled the house. He had spent most of the summer agonizing to the tramp of mustering regiments over what role he should play in the war. Although he was not yet 30 and in prime physical shape, his domestic situation was such that he could not contemplate taking up arms. Under his roof lived 3 women, Grandmother Bullock, Mittie, and her sister Annie, who owned slaves and a plantation and were passionate in their support of the Confederacy. Mittie allegedly once hung out the stars and bars after a Southern victory. 2 of Mrs. Bullock's sons were fighting for the South. Could he fire upon or receive the bullets of his brothers-in-law? In anguish, Theodore Sr. did what many of his wealthy friends were doing. He hired a substitute soldier. Yet, as a strong Lincoln Republican, his troublesome conscience would not let him rest. A certain strain developed between himself and his wife, although their mutual love never wavered. "I wish we sympathized together on this question of so vital moment to our country," he told her gently. "I know you cannot understand my feelings and, of course, do not expect it." Eventually, he announced that he had decided to aid the war effort in a civilian capacity, and, true to his nature, soon found a charitable cause. Already, in these early days of war, millions of government dollars were flowing through the pockets of Union soldiers and into the hands of sutlers, who infested military camps, hawking bottles of liquor hidden in loaves of bread. The sutlers charged such exorbitant prices that their customers soon had no money left to send home to their families. It was to right this wrong that Theodore Sr. set off to Washington, and, conquering his natural distaste for politics, began to lobby for remedial legislation. With 2 colleagues, he drafted a bill for the appointment of unpaid allotment commissioners, who would visit all military camps and persuade soldiers to set aside voluntary pay deductions for family support. This proposal, which eventually became standard military practice, seemed eccentric, if not downright suspect, in 1861, as a family friend recalled many years later. For 3 months they worked in Washington to secure the passage of this act, delayed by the utter inability of congressmen to understand why anyone should urge a bill from which no one could selfishly secure an advantage. When this was passed, he was appointed by President Lincoln one of the 3 commissioners from this state. For long, weary months, in the depth of a hard winter, he went from camp to camp, urging the men to take advantage of this plan. On the saddle, often 6 to 8 hours a day, standing in the cold and mud as long, addressing the men and entering their names. This resulted in sending many millions of dollars to homes where it was greatly needed, kept the memory of wives and children fresh in the minds of the soldiers, and greatly improved their morale. Other states followed, and the economical results were very great. Lincoln's private secretary, a round-headed, slant-eyed youth named John Hay, proved a willing conduit to the president, and Theodore Sr. made the most of his assistance. "It is a great luxury to feel I am at last doing something tangible for the country," he wrote Mittie. Homesickness nevertheless tugged at him. "I cannot," he confessed, "get Bammy's and Teedy's faces, as they bid me goodbye at the door, out of my mind." It is significant that Theodore Jr., when he came to write his own autobiography, made no mention whatsoever of his father's role in the Civil War, his invariable practice being to leave painful memories unspoken until they are too dead to throb. To serve in mufti was, in his opinion, something less than manly, and his tacit disapproval of the episode is the only indication that Theodore Sr. was ever less than a god to him. Many biographers, including his own sister, have suggested that guilt over that substitute soldier explains the future Rough Rider's almost desperate desire to wage war. He himself, at the age of 3, made no bones about his wish to be at the front. "Teedy was really excited," wrote Annie Bullock, "when I said to him, 'Darling, I must fit this zouave suit.' His little face flushed up, and he said, 'Are me a soldier, laddie?' I immediately took his own suggestion and told him he was and that I was the captain. His liveliness, abnormal even for a small boy, was something of a trial to the languid Mitty. 6 weeks after Theodore Sr.'s departure, she complained, "T.D. is the most affectionate and endearing little creature in his ways, but begins to require Papa's discipline rather sadly. He is brimming full of mischief and has to be watched all the time." Yet the child was simultaneously sinking into what seemed like chronic invalidism. From the moment his father left home, the catalogue of T.D.'s ailments became continuous. He suffered from coughs, colds, nausea, fevers, and a congenital form of nervous diarrhea, which the family euphemized as cholera morbus. "I feel badly," he told his mother one morning. "I have toothache in my stomach." On top of all this, his asthma was worsening. "Rarely, even at his best, could he sleep without being propped up in bed or in a big chair," remembered Corrine. Lack of appetite brought about symptoms of malnutrition. At one stage, his whiteness and fragility were such that Annie Bullock compared him to a very pale azalea. It seemed that he would not live to see his fourth birthday. The other children were not much healthier. Bammy, who had been dropped as a baby, suffered from a spinal defect that obliged her to wear a harness. Elliot was prone to colds and rushes of blood to the head. Even little Corrine was ailing and would soon fall victim to asthma as well. To Theodore Sr., sloughing tirelessly through the freezing mud of military camps, Mitty's letters made depressing reading. He was plainly bewildered by the fact that two such beautiful physical specimens had produced such a sickly brood of children. "I cannot help feeling," he wrote early in 1862, "that there must be something about the furnace or something that prevents them all from being healthy." With characteristic optimism, he hoped for improvements in the summer, when he would be home for a visit, and exhorted his wife, "Remember to enjoy yourself just as much as you can." How much T.D.'s asthma was aggravated by the absence of his father may be inferred from some remarks he made 37 years later to Lincoln Steffens after a steeplechase which left the reporter breathless. "Handsome dandy that he was, the thought of him now and always has been a sense of comfort. I could breathe, I could sleep when he had me in his arms. My father, he got me breath, he got me lungs, strength, life." When Theodore Sr. finally came home on leave of absence from Washington, the garden behind 28 East 20th Street was lush with summer, the children were better, and his own mood had improved. He was able to tell stories of rides with President and Mrs. Lincoln, who had apparently fallen victim, as everybody did sooner or later, to his charm. The First Lady even took him shopping and asked him to choose bonnets for her. The effect of his lusty reappearance in the household was like a tonic to his women and children. The latter especially worshipped him as though he were a sort of benevolent Norse god. During morning prayers, they would compete for the privilege of sitting in the cubbyhole, a favored stretch of sofa between his body and the mahogany arm. Later in the day, when he was away at work, they would wait for him on the piazza behind the house until his key rattled in the latch and he burst upon them laden with ice cream and peaches. He would feed the fruit to them as they lay spread-eagled on the edge of the piazza, letting the juice drip down into the garden. Afterward, they would troop into his room to look on while he undressed, eagerly watching his pockets for the treasures, heavy male trinkets which he would solemnly deposit in the box on his dressing table or, on occasion, present to a lucky child. This ritual would one day be faithfully reproduced by the President of the United States before his own children. Despite the joy Theodore Sr. felt at being at home again, he lost no time in restoring paternal discipline. It was during this summer that naughty T.D. felt for the first time the weight of his father's hand. "I bit my elder sister's arm. I do not remember biting her arm, but I do remember running down to the yard, perfectly conscious that I had committed a crime. From the yard I went into the kitchen, got some dough from the cook, and crawled under the kitchen table. In a minute or two my father entered from the yard and asked where I was. The warm-hearted Irish cook had a characteristic contempt for informers, but although she said nothing, she compromised between informing and her conscience by casting a look under the table. My father immediately dropped on all fours and darted at me. I feebly heaved the dough at him, and having the advantage of him because I could stand up under the table, got a fair start for the stairs, but was caught halfway up them. The punishment that ensued fitted the crime, and I hope, and believe, that it did me good. Theodore Sr. never chastised his son again. It was not necessary. There hung about his big, relaxed body an ever-present threat of violence, like that of a lion who, dozing, will suddenly flick out a lethal paw. His reaction to any form of wrong, in particular selfishness or cruelty, idleness, cowardice, or untruthfulness, was so quick and so certain that nobody, child or adult, crossed him more than once. "Be sure to make the children obey your first order," he told Mitty. Although her success was indifferent, they nevertheless came to understand that the same standard of clean living was demanded for the boys as for the girls, that what was wrong in a woman could not be right in a man. About the time Teddy turned 4 in October 1862, he began dimly to realize that his parents were not one in their views about the Civil War. These differences had been, for the most part, diplomatically concealed from the children during the summer, although Bammy recalled nights when Mitty would dine alone in her room rather than be exposed to the brutal unionism of male conversation downstairs. She must have been homesick for her own people until her heart bled in those early days. It was out of the very fullness of her heart that she used to tell us of home. Mitty, however, was not entirely alone. The flames of Southern patriotism burned as high in the breasts of her sister and mother, who, fond as they were of Theodore Sr., felt some embarrassment at having to live under the roof of a Lincoln Republican. As soon as their host left home, these scruples vanished, and the three women busied themselves in support of the Confederacy. There were days of hushed and thrilling excitement when little Teddy helped the ladies of the house pack mysterious boxes to run the blockade. As Teddy became aware of the intensity of their feelings, he learned to play upon them with some cruelty. "Once, when I felt I had been wronged by maternal discipline during the day, I attempted a partial vengeance by praying with loud fervor for the success of Union arms when we all came to say our prayers before my mother in the evening." Mitty's sense of humor neutralized this moment of truculence, so Teddy tried the same trick on Aunt Annie, who was much less amused. She said she would never forget the fury in the childish voice when he would plead with divine providence to grind the Southern troops to powder. Annie Bullock had volunteered to pay for her bed and board by giving all the Roosevelt children their first lessons, an offer her lethargic sister was only too happy to accept. Perhaps with some trepidation, she now undertook the education of Teddy. It was on her knee that he learned the three R's, and showed a decided preference for the first two at the expense of the third. Aunt Annie was a born teacher, energetic, practical, and kindly, with a dramatic flair that enlivened the dullest fact. Often as not, for she was an even better storyteller than her sister, the lessons would drift into reminiscences of the Old South. A mood of spinsterish melancholy colored Aunt Annie's tales of life on the Georgia plantations, of minuets under the mistletoe, and coach lamps drowned in warm darkness as lovesick young men drove away, forever. Of cockfights and turkey wrestling, of horses that had been named after, or, to a child who had only recently confused God with a fox, perhaps were Daniel Boone and Davy Crockett. Of the famous fighting bullocks and their exploits during the American Revolution. Of Brer Rabbit, the Tar Baby, and queer goings-on in the Negro quarters. Teddy thus, at a very early age, acquired a love for legend and anecdote, and inherited a nostalgia for a way of life he had never known. The key to his imagination had been unlocked by a woman to whom the past was more real than the present. As an adult reader of history, and as a professional writer of it, he always showed a tendency to live his subject. He always looked for narrative which was instinct with the truth that both charms and teaches. Since Aunt Annie had three other children to take care of, she could not spend all her time satisfying Teddy's lust for information, which rapidly became insatiable. Confined indoors by ill health and winter weather, he wheezed restlessly from room to room in search of further entertainment. For a while he amused himself with objets d'art in the parlor, a Russian mujik pulling a tin sledge across a snowfield of malachite, a carved Swiss hunter chasing chamois goats around an improbably small mountain, and floor-to-ceiling mirrors in which he could exchange stares with a small, blonde, stern-faced boy. Dominating his little universe, like some remote yet brilliant galaxy, was a gas chandelier coruscating with cut glass prisms. "These prisms struck me as possessing peculiar magnificence," he wrote in later life. "One of them fell off one day, and I hastily grabbed it and stowed it away, passing several days of furtive delight in the treasure, a delight always alloyed with fear that I would be found out and convicted of larceny." The splendors of the parlor soon palled. There was little to detain him in the dining room, except at mealtimes. Besides, its black haircloth furniture scratched his bare legs. The kitchen was terra non grata to pesky children. Eventually, he was forced to explore the most forbidding room in the house, a windowless library with tables, chairs, and gloomy bookcases. Chancing upon a ponderous edition of David Livingstone's Missionary Travels and Researches in Southern Africa, T.D. opened it, and found within a world he could happily inhabit the rest of his days. Although the book's pages of print meant nothing to him, its illustrations were copious, explicit, and strangely thrilling. Here were rampant hippopotami with canoes on their backs, horizon-filling herds of zebra, a magnified tsetse fly as big as his hand, and an elephant so spiked with assegais as to resemble an enormous porcupine. For weeks, T.D. dragged the volume, which was almost as big as he was, around the library, and begged his elders to fit stories to the pictures. Among the first books T.D. learned to decipher for himself were An Unscientific Study of Mammals by Mayne Reid, and Two Natural Histories by the English biologist J.G. Wood. He pored endlessly over these in the library, curled up in a tiny chair, which became his favorite article of furniture. Softly upholstered in red velvet and fringed with long tassels, it seemed designed to comfort the scrawny angles of his body. For years, the boy and his tassel chair were so inseparable, it even accompanied him to the photographer's studio for his formal birthday portraits. The library's gloom vanished at night when gas lamps began to hiss and the coal fire made its rugs and tapestries glow a rich, romantic red. T.D. was given free access to all the books on the shelves, save only a racy novel by Ouida, Under Two Flags. "I did read it, nevertheless, with greedy and fierce hope of coming on something unhealthy. But as a matter of fact, all the parts that might have seemed unhealthy to an older person made no impression on me. I simply enjoyed in a rather confused way the general adventures." As his reading abilities developed and his ill health continued, he turned more and more to stories of outdoor action, in which he could identify with heroes larger than life. The novels of Ballantyne, the sea yarns of Captain Marryat, Cooper's Tales of the American Frontier. Epic poetry, too, inspired him. Above all, Longfellow's Saga of King Olaf, with its wild warlocks, blaring horns, and shields shining like suns. "I was nervous and timid. Yet from reading of the people I admired, ranging from the soldiers of Valley Forge and Morgan's Riflemen to the heroes of my favorite stories, and from hearing of the feats performed by my southern forefathers and kinsfolk, and from knowing my father, I felt a great admiration for men who were fearless and could hold their own in the world, and I had a great desire to be like them." In the spring of 1863, Theodore Sr., whose voluntary war services were now more and more concentrated in New York State, transported his ailing family to Lone Taka, a country place in Madison, New Jersey. The children reacted to their rural surroundings with such delight and with such general improvement to their health that Lone Taka remained the Roosevelt summer home for four consecutive seasons. Here, the bookish T.D. became aware of the enthralling pleasures of building wigwams in the woods, gathering hickory nuts and apples, hunting frogs, haying and harvesting, and scampering barefoot down long, leafy lanes. Despite his frail physique and asthma, he seemed to have an inexhaustible fund of nervous energy. This, combined with the ability to improvise countless stories about his environment, caused him to be accepted as an unquestioned leader by Corrine and Elliot, and such family friends as came to stay. Bammy's four-year seniority, along with a certain adult seriousness of manner, disqualified her from membership in his gang. Even on days when illness confined him to bed, the other children would forsake the fields in order to be entertained by the prodigal T.D. His stories, remembered by Corrine into old age, were about jungles and bold, mighty, and imaginary fights with strange beasts. There was always a small boy in the stories who understood the language of animals and would translate their opinions to us. Even in these early years, his knowledge of natural history was abnormal. No doubt much of it was acquired during his winters in the tassel chair, but it was supplemented every summer by long hours of observation of the flora and fauna around him. The other children noticed that their leader also led a life apart from us, seriously studying birds, their habits, and their notes. At first, this study was haphazard, and Titi made no attempt to document his observations beyond filing them in his retentive memory. Not until he was 7 years old and back in New York City did his formal career as a zoologist begin. "I was walking up Broadway, and as I passed the market to which I used sometimes to be sent before breakfast to get strawberries, I suddenly saw a dead seal laid out on a slab of wood. That seal filled me with every possible feeling of romance and adventure. I asked where it was killed and was informed in the harbor. As long as that seal remained there, I haunted the neighborhood of the market day after day. I measured it, and I recall that not having a tape measure, I had to do my best to get its girth with a folding pocket foot rule, a difficult undertaking. I carefully made a record of the utterly useless measurements and at once began to write a natural history of my own on the strength of that seal. This and subsequent natural histories were written down in blank books in simplified spelling, wholly unpremeditated and unscientific. I had vague aspirations of, in some way or another, owning that seal, but they never got beyond the purely formless stage. I think, however, I did get the seal's skull, and with two of my cousins promptly started what we ambitiously called the Roosevelt Museum of Natural History." His next major thesis was entitled The Foregoing Ant. According to Corrine, it was inspired by a passing reference in Wood's Natural History. Titi assumed that the adjective was physiological, perhaps referring to the ant's gait, and his subsequent essay on the subject was read aloud to a circle of mystified adults. Unfortunately for posterity, neither the Broadway seal nor the foregoing ant appear in surviving records of Titi's museum. There exists, however, a rather more learned opus entitled Natural History on Insects, which dates from his 9th year. "All the insects that I write about in this book," the author declares, "inhabit North America. Now and then a friend has told me something about them, but mostly I have gained their habits from observation." He discusses and illustrates various species of ants, spiders, ladybugs, fireflies, horned beetles, and dragonflies. Then, with a fine disregard for the limitations of his title, he moves on to the study of hawks, minnows, and crayfish. The latter rather defeats his childish powers of description. "Look at a lobster," he suggests, "and you have its form." Apart from such lapses, Titi's observation is amazingly keen. A paragraph on the tree spider, for example, notes that it is gray spotted with black and lives in communities of about 20 under patches of loosened bark. Its web looks exactly like some cotton on the top, but if you take that off, you will see several small little webs, all in a jumble, as we children used to call it, each having several little occupants. Even more remarkable for a 9-year-old boy is the methodical arrangement of classifications and the patient indexing. Titi's interest in all curiosities and living things became something of a trial to his elders. Meeting Mrs. Hamilton Fish on a streetcar, he absent-mindedly lifted his hat, whereupon several frogs leaped out of it to the dismay of fellow passengers. Houseguests at number 28 learned to sit on sofas warily and to check their water pitchers for snakes before pouring. When Mitty, in great disgust, threw out a litter of field mice, her son loudly bemoaned, "The loss to science! The loss to science!" From time to time, members of the domestic staff threatened to give notice. A protest by a chambermaid forced Titi to move the Roosevelt Museum of Natural History out of his bedroom and into the back hall upstairs. "How can I do the laundry," complained the washerwoman, "with a snapping turtle tied to the legs of the sink?" Finally, when a noxious odor permeated the entire house, even the good-natured cook issued her ultimatum. "Either I leave, or the woodchuck does." Titi had killed a fine specimen for anatomical study and ordered her to boil the animal, fur and all, for 24 hours. On 28 April 1868, Titi wrote a letter to Mitty, who was paying a visit to Savannah along with Theodore Sr. and Corrine. It is the earliest of his 150,000 letters to survive, yet there glitters in virtually every sentence a facet of his mature personality. "My dear Mama, I have just received your letter. What an excitement! What long letters you do write. I don't see how you can write them. My mouth opened wide with astonish when I heard how many flowers were sent in to you. I could revel in the buggy ones. I jumped with delight when I found you heard the mockingbird. Get some of its feathers if you can. Thank Johnny for the feathers of the soldier's cap. Give him my love also. We cried when you wrote about Grandmama. Give my love to the good-natured, to use your own expression, handsome lion, Coney, Johnny, Maud, and Aunt Lucy. I am sorry the trees have been cut down. Aunt Annie, Edith, and Ellie send their love to you and all. I sent mine, too. In the letter you write me, tell me how many curiosities and living things you have got for me. I miss Coney very much. I wish I were with you and Johnny, for I could hunt for myself. Yours lovingly, Theodore Roosevelt. P.S. I liked your peas so much that I ate half of them. Promptness, excitability, warmth, histrionics, love of plants and animals, physical vitality, delight, sensitivity to birdsong, fascination with military display, humor, family closeness, the conservationist, the natural historian, the hunter, all are here. T.D. mentions Passim, the name of his future wife, and there is a hint of the 200-pound president in the embarrassed postscript. Even the large, childish handwriting is touchingly similar to that of the dying Colonel Roosevelt, scrawling his last memorandum half a century later. During the summer of 1868, about the same time he was completing his natural history on insects, T.D. began to keep a diary. The Roosevelts were then living in their new country place on Berrytown-on-Hudson, New York, and the little volume is full of the joys of bird nesting, swimming, hiking, and long rides through grass up to the pony's head. Apart from one reference to an attack of the asthma on 10 August, the diary reads like that of any normal 9-year-old. Yet T.D.'s health was as bad as ever. He was never well for more than 10 days at a time. So accustomed was he by now to recurrences of illness that he rarely bothered to record them. Theodore Sr. grew seriously worried as the summer went by, and Teddy, for all his hyperactivity, remained pasty-faced and skeletal. The other children were blooming in comparison, but only with their brother. Bammy's crippled spine, Elliot's tendency to rushes of blood in the head, and little Kareem's own asthma tormented all his protective feelings. Yet another cause for alarm was the strange decline of Mitty Roosevelt. A certain wistfulness, combined with increasing fragility and indolence, had begun to affect this exquisite woman since the end of the Civil War. It was as if Sherman's looting of her ancestral home and the simultaneous death of her mother, not to mention the banishment overseas of her 2 secessionist brothers, had cut the southern lifelines that hitherto sustained her. Gradually, she sank into a kind of gentle invalidism, which was something not unlike a second childhood. Always helpless and fluttery, she grew incapable of running the house, and was treated by her children as one of its prettier ornaments, a doll in the parlor whom they could pet when they chose. "Sweet little China Dresden mother," Elliot used to call her affectionately. Coaches summoned to take her for her 3 o'clock drive would creak up and down 20th Street for hours, while Mitty made flustered attempts to get ready. Often as not, she would never emerge at all. Although she remained beautiful, charming, and witty, Theodore Sr. was saddened to see yet another blossom wilt upon his boughs. When Mitty herself suggested in the winter of 1868-69 that a trip to Europe might do the whole family good, he welcomed the idea. His business was prospering, and after the hard grind of his war work, a grand tour of Europe sounded like a welcome diversion. It would be of immense educational value to the children, none of whom had yet received outside schooling. With characteristic enthusiasm, Theodore Sr. sat down and drafted an itinerary that must have given his wife pause, for it covered 9 countries and a whole year of traveling time. The children reacted with even more dismay. They had been hoping to return to the Hudson Valley that summer. Theodore Sr. turned a deaf ear to their pleas and went ahead with the bookings. On 12 May 1869, he escorted his tearful brood aboard the paddle steamer Scotia, bound for Liverpool. Although T.D. later declared that he cordially hated the Roosevelt Grand Tour, he recorded it at great length in his diaries. During all the 377 days he was away from home, he did not miss a single entry, with the exception of 1 stormy week on the return crossing. The spelling in these cheap, battered notebooks is that of a child, but the density of remembered detail would be extraordinary even in an adult. Some entries read like miniature museum catalogs. Evidently, the cornucopia of Europe awakened his faculty of near total recall. The diaries began on an enigmatic note. "It was very hard parting from our friend," T.D. writes, confessing that he cried a great deal. This mysterious person was almost certainly a 7-year-old girl named Edith Caro. For as far back as he could remember, quiet, steady-eyed little Edie had been his most intimate acquaintance outside the family circle. Indeed, it seemed at times that she lived within it, for her father's house was on Union Square, only a few blocks away from 28 East 20th Street, and she had come to regard the latter as her second home. Edith and Corrine had been born within weeks of each other and were wheeled side by side in their baby carriages. When Aunt Annie began giving lessons to the younger Roosevelts, it was natural that Edith should be included. Although she was, in these early years, more attached to Corrine than anyone else, it was plain that a special relationship was developing between herself and T.D. He was permitted to play house with her, whereas Elliot was not. They shared a passionate interest in books, and their characters complemented each other. Where he was ardent and impulsive, feverish in his enthusiasms, she was sensitive and cautious, a cooling breeze across his sometimes overheated landscape. Seasickness and homesickness were added to T.D.'s normal quota of ills as the Scotia thrashed her way slowly across the Atlantic. He remained aloof from the deck games of other children on board, burying himself in books or else gazing vaguely at gulls and passing ships. A tall, thin lad, someone remembered, with bright eyes and legs like pipe stems. During the latter part of the voyage, he made friends with a learned gentleman from West Indies and had long conversations with him on the subject of natural history. Late on the evening of 21 May, the ship docked at Liverpool, and T.D. set foot in Britain for the first time. While Mitty plunged into an ecstatic 10-day reunion with her exiled brothers, the younger Roosevelts jumped and romped on the chilly English seashore. Theodore Sr., however, had not brought them abroad to play, and began to expose them to the bewildering variety of English history and architecture. Trips were made to the Duke of Devonshire's country seat at Chatsworth, and Haydon Hall, an old feudal castle of the 11th century, where T.D. admired the leathern jacket in which a lord received his death wound. In early June, they proceeded north via Furness Abbey and the Lake District to Edinburgh. Despite the inevitable Scottish rain, T.D. overcame an attack of asthma and greatly enjoyed visits to Walter Scott's mansion at Abbotsford, the Tweed, quite a decent brook, and Loch Lomond, where the poem Lady of the Lake was laid. The pace of sightseeing intensified as the Roosevelt swung south via York to Oxford, by which time the young diarist had developed a formidable headache. "I have a tendency to headache," he noted in London 5 days later, apparently still suffering. He was a little disappointed at the range of fauna in the zoological gardens, but had fun playing in Hyde Park and visiting Westminster Abbey. The rare and beautiful specimens in the British Museum fascinated him, as did the Crystal Palace, with its imitations of Egyptian, Roman, Greek, etc. marbles, and the ancient Tower of London, where I put my head on the block where so many had been beheaded. During this stay, a doctor examined him and pronounced his lungs perfect. T.D. was immediately stricken with asthma so violent he had to be rushed to Hastings for 3 days of sea air. On 13 July, the Roosevelt sailed down the Thames, a very, very small river or a large creek, and crossed the English Channel to Antwerp. T.D. prided himself on being the last of his family to vomit, and the first one that got on the continent. From Antwerp, they began a leisurely tour of the Netherlands and northern Germany. While traveling up the Rhine, T.D. began to wheeze and cough. A rainy visit to Strasbourg made him very sick, and he spent the next morning in bed. In Switzerland, he suffered alternate attacks of gastroenteritis, toothache, and asthma, yet showed amazing bursts of energy in between. He climbed an 8,000-foot mountain at Chamonix, scorning mules, walked 19 miles across the Tête Noire, La Tête Noire, 13 miles around Visp, 20 miles through the Grimsel Pass, and ascended alone the steep hill of Wallenstein. "It is 3 and 3 miles back, and I went and came in 1 hour." Such incredible statistics might be dismissed as boyish exaggeration, were it not for the fact that Theodore Sr. frequently accompanied him and confirmed them. In his diaries, as in all his later writings, Teedy was a scrupulously accurate reporter. Despite recurring moments when the boy was very, very homesick, he continued to stare seriously at everything around him, sketching the plan of a grotto in Geneva, comparing live Swiss chamois with the carved ones at home in East 20th Street, exploring the gloomy dungeons of Chillon Castle, researching everything he saw in guidebooks and geographies. In lighter moments, he clowned raucously with Elliot and Corrine, gorged himself on fresh berries and cream, and waged war upon several cross chambermaids. On 9 September, Teedy and his father hiked over the crest of the Splugen Pass. The other Roosevelts followed in a carriage. "Soft, balmy Italy of the poets," Teedy noted sarcastically, "is cold, dreary, smelly." However, the scenery around Lake Como soon improved his attitude, and after a row across the lake, by the light of a golden moon, he himself began to wax poetical. "I strayed from the rest, and now in the wood around the Villa Collata, with no sound save the waterfall and Italian breeze on my cheek, I all alone am writing my journal." The moon changed to silver over Lake Lugano, and Isola Bella on Lake Maggiore was the most beautiful creation of man's, with lemons, cactuses, camphor trees, lemons, bamboos, sugar cane inside of snow-white Alps. Here a particularly vicious attack of asthma struck. "It came to a point," wrote Mitty to her sister, "where he had to sit up in bed to breathe. After taking a strong cup of black coffee, the spasmodic part of the attack ceased, and he slept. Had the coffee not taken effect, he would have gone on struggling through the night and been a complete wreck the next morning, in which condition you have so often seen him." Teedy's dormant literary talents were stimulated afresh by Venice. "We saw the moonlight on the water, and I contrasted it with the black gondolas darting about like water goblins." Although the weather here was clear and dry, he became so dreadfully ill that on 20 September he collapsed in total exhaustion. During the next 2 weeks, his attacks of diarrhea and asthma were incessant. "One night on the Austrian border, I sat up for 4 successive hours, and Papa made me smoke a cigar. This unorthodox remedy seems to have had temporary effect, for the following day he climbed the Adelsberg for 2 hours in the broiling sun. But the long train trip to Vienna laid him low yet again." Theodore Sr., whose compassion for his son was tempered by an aggressive attitude to illness, refused to mollycoddle him. After only a day in bed, Teedy was whisked off to the treasury to see the crowns of Charlemagne and Rudolf II, rudely carved jewels and pearls yellow with age, contrasting strangely with the polished pearls and sparkling gems of modern times. "Then Father and I went to a natural history museum. It is a most interesting place, but I was hurried." Throughout Teedy's diaries, the masterful, all-capable figure of Theodore Sr. strides with giant steps, tirelessly encouraging, comforting, supervising, and protecting his family. Handsome and resplendent in evening dress, he escorts Mitty and Bammy to the Vienna Opera. He leaps like a tiger upon a monk who shoves Teedy aside and hurls him bodily into the crowd. Determined to picnic in an attractive orange grove, he overcomes the hostility of peasants and proprietor and ends up gaily entertaining all comers to chicken, champagne, and honey. Only once in the entire 12-month tour does he lose patience with his children and angrily call them bothers. Even this mild imprecation is enough to make Teedy miserable for a whole evening. As autumn settled over the Alps, the frequency of Teedy's asthma attacks increased until they were rarely more than 3 days apart. His diaries become poignant reading. "In Salzburg, I had a nightmare dreaming that the devil was carrying me away and have cholera morbus. In Munich, I was very sick. Mama was so kind telling me stories and rubbing me with her delicate fingers. In Dresden, somebody more vigorous massaged his chest until the blood came out." Yet the touring and sightseeing relentlessly continued. Teedy calculated that the Roosevelt Grand Tour was not yet half over, and he was overcome by a paroxysm of homesickness. "October 17th, Sunday, Dresden. I am by the fire with not another light, but it is now after 5. All was dark except the fire. I lay by it and listened to the wind and thought of the times at home in the country when I lay by the fire with some hickory nuts until, like the slave who, again he is king by the banks of the Niger, again he can hear the wild roar of the tiger. Again I was lying by the roaring fire, with the cold October wind shrieking outside, in the cheerful lighted room, and I turned around half expecting to see it all again, and stern reality forced itself upon me, and I thought of the time that would come never, never, never. His misery lasted through visits to Berlin and Cologne, where he noted gloomily that 27 October was the first of my birthdays that it snowed on. However, the Roosevelts celebrated the occasion with their customary blend of warmth and formality, donning full evening dress for dinner and showering him with such splendid gifts that his mood noticeably improved. 5 days into his 12th year, the child gives the first of several indications that the man is beginning to develop within him. We went to a shoemaker's in Brussels and I saw a girl, the most beautiful but ferocious girl I have ever seen in my life. Another more emotional entry, written 3 weeks later in Paris, records that Mama showed me the portrait of Edith Carrow, and her face stirred up in me homesickness and longings for the past, which will come again never, alack never. Titi remained depressed and ill in Paris. A doctor was summoned to his bedside 3 times, and 3 times changed his medicine. But neither this nor frequent Russian baths had any effect. When at the end of November the Roosevelt started south to winter on the Riviera, his melancholy spilled out in tears. I cried for homesickness and a wish to get out of the land where friends, or as I think them, enemies, who cannot speak my language, are forced on me. But the inexorable Theodore Sr. pressed on down the Route Napoleon. On 6 December, Titi was cheered by his first decent hill climb in months, but his health was still a cause for concern. I read till Mama came in, and then she lay down and I stroked her head, and she felt my hands and nearly cried because they were feverish. As they proceeded east along the Riviera, his powers of observation revived. The diaries have vignettes of cruelty to animals, the military might of Monaco, a few gendarmes and some dismounted cannon, primitive house paintings, and a very romantic sunset on the Italian border. At Finale, the Roosevelts amused themselves in jingoistic fashion with a crowd of Italian beggars. We hired one to keep off the rest. Then came some more fun. Papa bought 2 baskets of doughy cakes, a great crowd of boys, girls, and women. We tossed the cakes to them, and we fed them like chickens with small pieces of cake, and like chickens they ate it. Mr. Stevens, a fellow traveler, kept guard with a whip with which he pretended to whip a small boy. We made them open their mouths and tossed cake into it. For a coup de grace, we threw a lot of them in a place and a writhing heap of human beings. We made the crowds give us 3 cheers for USA before we gave them cakes. Unfazed by such alarming evidence of Italian poverty, Titi once again rhapsodized over the beauties of the Mediterranean landscape. His diary entries double or triple in length, to as much as 1,000 words a day. Moving leisurely down the Ligurian coast via Genoa and Pisa, the Roosevelt family arrived in Rome in time for Christmas. "Hip, hip, hurrah!" rejoiced Titi. The presents passed our utmost expectations. Rome, on the other hand, did not. His first impression of it, through rainy windows, was a dirty jumble of old buildings. But when the weather improved, he explored the city and its environs enthusiastically, from the depths of the catacombs to the heights of Rocca di Papa, Rocca di Papa. He showed similar conscientiousness on an excursion to Naples and Pompeii. The temptingly precipitous and icy slopes of Vesuvius enabled him to work off his superabundant energy on the last day of 1869. Reaching the summit long before other members of the family, Titi happily inhaled sulfur fumes until his bronchi rebelled and threw pebbles into the lava, careless of the turbulence that spewed them back into his face. New Year's Day, 1870, came and went, and from the children's point of view, the worst part of the grand tour was over. Although several months of winter in Europe yet remained, spring was on its way, and the longed-for recrossing of the Atlantic no longer wavered in the impossible distance like a mirage. For 6 weeks in Rome, while the elder Roosevelt socialized with fashionable American expatriates, they became ball-playing regulars on Pinchon Hill. Here, one glistening January day, suddenly there came a stir, and unexpected excitement seemed everywhere. Gorgeously robed San Petrini approached, carrying an august personage in a sedan chair. Titi, conscious of his Dutch Reformed heritage, hissed frantically that he didn't believe in popes, that no real American would. As Corrine later recalled, "The Pope, his benign face framed in white hair and the close cap which he wore, caught sight of the group of eager little children craning their necks to see him pass, and he smiled and put out one fragile, delicate hand toward us, and lo, the late scoffer who, in spite of the ardent Americanism that burned in his 11-year-old soul, had as much reverence as militant patriotism in his nature, fell upon his knees and kissed the delicate hand, which for a brief moment was laid upon his fair curly hair." Teedy, recording the incident in his diary that night, was much less sentimental. "We saw the Pope, and we walked along, and he extended his hand to me, and I kissed it.
Hem, hem!"
The rest of his stay in Rome was happy, educational, and comparatively free from illness. So were two subsequent weeks spent touring the galleries of Florence, Bologna, and Turin. Teedy revealed a precocious sensitivity to art, commenting in his diary on as many as 57 items in a single day. He was particularly moved by the most beautiful of all beautiful pictures, St. Cecilia listening to the heavenly music. On 10 March 1870, Theodore Sr. took his family back to Paris for 7 more weeks of sightseeing. Damp and snowy weather aggravated Teedy's asthma, necessitating quick excursions out of town to Fontainebleau. As spring came in, the air warmed and sweetened, and he enjoyed "the happiest Easter I ever spent." At the end of April, Bammy, who was to stay in France for a year of finishing school, bade everybody a tearful goodbye. Recrossing the Channel for a final fortnight in England, the Roosevelts embarked from Liverpool on 14 May in a calm shower of rain. As they drew near to America, a joyous escort of whales sprayed Teedy with water. Sandy Hook drifted into view. The spires of Manhattan grew tall against the sky, dipped, swayed, and came to rest.
"New York! Hip, hurrah! What a bustle we had getting off!"
Chapter 2. The Mind, But Not the Body. Then, with a smile of joy defiant on his beardless lip, scaled he light and self-reliant Eric's dragon ship. Teedy's first adolescent stirrings, stimulated by the overwhelming impact of Europe, relapsed into dormancy in the familiar surroundings of New York City and the Hudson Valley. He was once again, through the long summer and fall of 1870, a bookish, bug-loving boy. His diary entries dwindled to single portmanteau sentences. "July 16. I hunted for birds' nests and in the afternoon went swimming and got caught in the rain. July 17. Went to Sunday school, wrote a letter, and played about. July 18. Hunted for birds' nests and went over to the Harrimans for tea and had a nice time." He does not even bother to record the arrival, one squally September evening, of a very important guest. "Mitty," said Theodore Sr., as the family clustered around, "I want to present to you a young man who in the future, I believe, will make his name well known in the United States. This is Mr. John Hay, and I wish the children to shake hands with him." Teedy obeyed, and for a moment looked gravely into the eyes of his future Secretary of State. The boy's only sign of physical development, as his 12th birthday approached, was a rapid increase in height, unaccompanied by any muscular filling out. His resemblance to a stork was accentuated by a habit of reading on one leg, while supporting a book on the jibbed thigh of the other. His health was, if anything, worse than ever. At least 3 times during the summer, Theodore Sr. had to take him across state for changes of air. When the Roosevelts returned to East 20th Street in late September, Teedy was subjected to a thorough medical examination. Dr. A.D. Rockwell found him a bright, precocious boy, by no means robust, and recommended plenty of fresh air and exercise. This advice seemed superfluous, for Teedy was, on his good days, almost frenziedly active out of doors. But it related in particular to the development of his chest. The lungs crammed into that narrow cavity were themselves crammed with asthma, and the mere act of breathing placed a strain on his heart. Theodore Sr. pondered Rockwell's diagnosis and decided the time had come to present a major challenge to his son. Accordingly, he sent for him.
"Theodore," the big man said, eschewing boyish nicknames, "you have the mind, but you do not have the body, and without the help of the body, the mind cannot go as far as it should. You must make your body. It is hard drudgery to make one's body, but I know you will do it. Mitty, who was an eyewitness, reported that the boy's reaction was the half-grin, half-snarl, which later became world-famous. Jerking his head back, he replied through clenched teeth, "I'll make my body." The promise, once made, was adhered to with bulldog tenacity. T.D. began to make daily visits to Woods Gymnasium, where he swung chest weights with such energy that his mother wondered aloud how many horsepower he was expending. At home, Theodore Sr. fitted out the second-floor piazza with an arsenal of athletic equipment and encouraged T.D. to spend all his spare time out there exercising. The piazza was a pleasant place for a city boy to work out. It faced south across the enormous Golette Garden, whence floated a constant supply of plant-purified air. Since the row of houses opposite, on the far side of 19th Street, was low, sunshine poured down all day, all year round. Here, to the caw of peacocks and magpies and the occasional moo of a cow, T.D. pushed and pulled and stretched and swung, working himself into the rhythmic trance of the true bodybuilder. "For many years," wrote Corrine afterward, "one of my most vivid recollections is seeing him between horizontal bars, widening his chest by regular, monotonous motion, drudgery indeed." Drudgery it may have seemed to the little girl, but to a boy of such hyperactive temperament as T.D., the work was both a release and a pleasure. He exercised throughout the winter and spring of 1870-71. Fiber by fiber, his muscles tautened, while the skinny chest expanded by degrees perceptible only to himself. But the overall results were dramatic. There is not a single mention of illness in his diary throughout August of 1871, his longest spell of health in years. Glorying in his newfound strength, he plunges into the depths of icy rapids and clambers to the heights of seven mountains, one of them twice on the same day. Along with this physical exuberance, he develops a more studious interest in nature. Observed species are now identified by their full zoological names. Paddling across Lake Regis, T.D. discovers flocks of Aethia americana and Colymbus torquatus. A Bareli alcyon dives for fish, and a Putorius vison swims across his path, while coveys of Oritix virginianus and Bonassa umbellus rise from the banks on either side. Riding behind a stagecoach to O'Sable Forks, he jumps off whenever he sees a particularly beautiful lichen or moss, and collects several hundred specimens for preservation in the Roosevelt Museum of Natural History. T.D.'s 13th winter and spring were much the same as his 12th, except that the weights on the chest machine were heavier and his hours on the piazza longer. Meanwhile, he continued to read voraciously. A friend of the period remembered him as the most studious little brute I ever knew in my life. Private tutors coached him in English, French, German, and Latin. There were rumors of another terrible trip to Europe, and a white-haired old gentleman who had been an associate of the great Audubon gave him lessons in taxidermy. This smelly subject quickly became his major passion, restrained only by the supply of available carcasses. Then, in the summer of 1872, T.D. acquired his first gun. It was, in his later description, "a breech-loading, pin-fire, double-hyphen barrel of French manufacture. An excellent gun for a clumsy and often absent-minded boy. There was no spring to open it, and if the mechanism became rusty, it could be opened with a brick without serious damage. When the cartridges stuck, they could be removed in the same fashion. If they were loaded, however, the result was not always happy, and I tattooed myself with partially unburned grains of powder more than once." Although T.D. blazed away determinedly at the fauna of the lower Hudson Valley, the Roosevelts had taken a summer house at Dobbs Ferry, he found, to his bewilderment, that he could not hit anything. Even more puzzling was the fact that his friends, using the same gun, seemed to be able to bag the invisible. They fired into the blue blur of the sky or the green blur of the trees, whereupon specimens mysteriously dropped out of nowhere. The truth was slow to dawn on him. "One day they read aloud an advertisement in huge letters on a distant billboard, and I then realized that something was the matter, for not only was I unable to read the sign, but I could not even see the letters. I spoke of this to my father, and soon afterwards got my first pair of spectacles, which literally opened an entirely new world to me. I had no idea how beautiful the world was until I got those spectacles, While much of my clumsiness and awkwardness was doubtless due to general characteristics, a good deal of it was due to the fact that I could not see, and yet was wholly ignorant that I was not seeing.